Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. Online, that's bcfmradio.com. This week, Dialect's Imogen Sawatka interviews her father, that is Mark Sawatka, the General Secretary of PCS Union, one of the biggest unions in the country. Also, Sophie Sweetman, she's a freelance journalist and a blogger. She asks about the monopolies going on in our smartphones with Microsoft and Google, kicking out people like Nokia and BlackBerry. And Kenyon Gibson, he's a former naval intelligence veteran from the United States, and he talks about Syria and the rise of fascism both in America and here in Britain. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectsradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, I'll give details at the end of the show.
I'm about to interview Mark Sawatka, the General Secretary of PCS, who also happens to be my father. Despite our family ties, I am inclined to ask him some difficult questions about the future of the trade union movement and its place in the politics of tomorrow. So, Mark, you've had a bit of time off dealing with some health issues. Can you give us a sense of what you've been up to recently?
Well, as you said, I have had some serious health issues. In fact, I had a heart transplant 6 months ago, and I've only been back in work for the last couple of months, having had 6 months off. Obviously, that was quite a trying time, but I kept working during my stay in hospital as much as I could. But since I've been back at work, I've made it a priority to travel around the country, meeting the staff of my union, the members of my union, and our reps, and doing as many public meetings in the UK as I can to get a feel as to where people think we are at the moment and to discuss with them what I think we need to be doing in this very interesting period.
How exactly does it feel to go from spending a total of 4 months in hospital to being back on the political front line with a new heart to boot?
Well, the first thing that I would share, I think, about my own personal health issues was just how marvellous our NHS is. The staff who looked after me, who come from all parts of the world, give me the most incredible treatment, fixed what was a very serious life-threatening condition, and now I feel better than I felt for the last 20 years. And my time in hospital was a mixture of, obviously, all the emotions you go through with your family about being in a very serious condition, but carrying on working, doing what I could, a lot of it by email and phone calls and people coming to the hospital. But, of course, it couldn't make up for the fact that much of the important part of being a union leader is actually being out there meeting people, having meetings with employers and doing public meetings. And so it was a difficult time. I kept in touch and I think we kept things ticking over because we have an excellent team at PCS headquarters who kept the union running really, really well. But now that I'm back, I'm throwing myself right back into it, doing what I enjoy most, which is really meeting people face to face.
It strikes me as particularly interesting that you did decide to come back after all that time.
Well, two things I'd say. Firstly, I had been ill for 6 years, more or less, and obviously that affected how I could do my job, but I was still able to do it, albeit it got more and more difficult towards the end stages of my illness. But once I'd had my operation, because I felt so well, because I'm still relatively young, and because I believe that unions do such an important job and I love my work and I'm very committed to that work, I wanted to get stuck in as soon as I could. The fact that we're in the most interesting political time probably in 30 or 40 years actually helped and actually meant that what I'm throwing myself into now isn't just about battles that you think are right to undertake but you may not think you're going to win. It's actually a period now where I think an awful lot can change for working men and women in this country, and I'm determined to do my bit as part of that.
Taking all that into account then, I want to ask you whether you think that unions have had their day potentially.
Well, that is said by some, and I think that is wished for by most people on the political right in this country, like the Conservative government, who don't believe in unions, because they know that what unions are all about is giving people a chance. They know that the world at work is a very unequal place where employers hold all of the cards and workers can often be badly treated. And the only thing that workers can do is to come together in a union to collectively demand that they're treated fairly. So I think there will always be a role for trade unions as long as we have a society where companies seek to make lots of profits, that they can exploit the people who ultimately make the profits for them. And so that hasn't changed. But your question is right. Unions are half the size they were in the 1970s. And I think our job has to be more relevant to young people, to be more relevant to people in a changing world at work, people who work for Uber or Deliveroo, people who are part-time workers, people who had 0 hours contracts. Unions must become somewhere that those people can relate to. And I think we've got a big job of work to do to make that happen.
Do you think you can turn these numbers around? Do you think you can potentially increase your membership?
I have no doubt about that at all. And in fact, what I think anyone who's been involved in a union will tell you is that when unions are campaigning, they're fighting for members, and particularly when they start winning, unions can grow quite rapidly. But as you said earlier, you know, it's been a difficult time. We've had, first of all, Mrs. Thatcher's government in the 80s and 90s that was very anti-union and defeated some of the big unions in this country, like the mine workers and the dockers and the steel workers. And now, most recently, we've had a Conservative government championing austerity that has tried to destroy unions. And they haven't destroyed us, but we have taken a hit. Mm-hmm. And as you said, we didn't win on public sector pensions and we haven't managed to stem the tide of austerity, but we can do that. And I'm actually very confident that if the unions go on the front foot and start talking about the things that matter to people and fighting for the things that matter, for example, at the moment on public sector pay, where I believe if all the unions come together and take industrial action, we can smash the pay cap. And then nurses and doctors and council workers and civil servants would all benefit, so will their families. And if we do that, you watch the union numbers grow, because people will join an organisation that is winning for them.
Cheap international labour is always going to undermine union power from now on.
Well, that's certainly the agenda of people who want a race to the bottom. And they want to bring in people to this country and undercut wages and conditions in order to do things on the cheap. And some people, I think, wrongly blame that on the workers who come to this country. And that's why there's a lot of anti-immigration sentiment, allegedly, amongst people. But I think the blame for that does not lie with those who come here. It comes with the unscrupulous bosses who are trying to make more and more profits by exploiting people. So the answer to that, I think, has to be that unions have got to recruit migrant workers. We've got to make conditions rise upwards, not level down to the bottom. And we've got to say, whether you're from India or you're from Poland or you're from Bristol, it's in all of our interests to stand together so that companies cannot exploit your labour to make more profits. There's been a race to the bottom in this country now ever since the financial crash in 2008. And the job of the unions is to lift people's aspirations, to say we want to rise up living standards for people at work. But actually, we want to do so much more than that, because we also want to change politics in this country. That's not about austerity and cuts in public services. It is about growing the economy, better skills, better training, better paid jobs, which will bring in more taxes, which will mean we won't have to close libraries and we won't have to have big class sizes in schools. We can have a society, actually, where people being in work and paying tax can benefit everybody who uses public services.
So on that note, can you sum up in 3 concise points what you think trade unions must be doing going into the future?
Well, first of all, we have to appeal to the millions of people who are at work who are not in a union. And we have to, first of all, say to them they need to join a union and explain to them why. That's the first fundamental task that faces us. Secondly, we need to ensure that unions are more effective, that they represent people better, that they are bolder, and that they can take action on behalf collectively of people in workplaces to better terms and conditions. And thirdly, unions have got to become much more political, and they have got to realise at the moment the debate in this country is between those who are for the few, which is the Conservatives with their austerity agenda, and those who are for the many, which is Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. And the unions have to ensure that if we get radical and campaign in the workplace for social justice, allied to Jeremy Corbyn's battle to try and bring social justice to everyone in the UK, we can transform this society. And if the society is transformed, unions will grow as a result.
What would you consider to be your greatest success since becoming the General Secretary of PCS?
There's 2 things that really stick out. First of all, I think, was the massive growth in the union, which went from being a sort of small, unnoticed civil service union to be seen as one of the most radical unions in the UK, that has championed anti-austerity politics, that first talked about an alternative to austerity before any other union in Britain, and has developed, I think, incredibly good campaigning and political links that is really part of the political debate in this country. But on a concrete level, I think one of our greatest achievements was back with the Labour government when it started cutting people's pensions, and it threatened to force people to work longer, to pay more and to get less for their pension. And our union, PCS, led the charge for there to be solidarity and a united front. And it resulted in a deal being done with the then Labour government that protected the pensions of every single person who was currently employed in the public sector. That was one of our big achievements. And I think PCS played a very important part of that.
And what, on the reverse side of that coin, would you say has been your greatest failure?
Well, firstly, I think collectively, the greatest failure of the trade unions to date has been not opposing austerity vigorously enough. We've done lots of speeches, we've pointed out why austerity is wrong, but if you look at what's happened in the last 7 years, there's been millions of jobs cut from the public sector, people's pensions have been cut, people's pay in real terms has gone down, and therefore our collective failure has been an inability to challenge what the Coalition and the Conservative government has done. And from a PCS perspective, we have our own version of that because we haven't been able to stop 110,000 cuts in British civil servants. We have the smallest civil service now since the Second World War, and we haven't been able to defend people's pay and pensions so far in the civil service. We've been successful at fighting some defensive battles, and we've won some very important campaigns, but overall, our members' living standards have gone down, their pensions are worse, and we've lost jobs. And that's ultimately because it's the government who is the hardest opponent of all that we've had to take on. And I think that what we now have an opportunity to say is, well, the last 7 years have been tough, but if we learn those lessons and we are far more prepared to work together, particularly given how weak this current government now is, we can stop these cuts, we can stop all the office closures, we can stop the huge cuts in public spending, and we can ensure our members have better living standards and more secure jobs. We haven't managed to do that to date, but I think we can do that in the future.
That sounds to me like the negatives outweigh the positives.
Well, I think I'm being honest and frank, and there are some who I think would try to sugarcoat some of that and pretend it wasn't as bad as it is. But I have made speeches that have got under some people's noses, to be honest, where I have said when history is written, the unions will have seemed to have failed in fighting austerity since 2010. And I think that they failed because we weren't prepared. And I have to say, in PCS's defence, that we have argued every single year that the answer to this is if the unions stand together, then they can't get away with the things they're doing. But unfortunately, unions have acted individually and been picked off one by one. And I think anyone listening to this will understand that if 6 million people, or if we just take the public sector, 3.5 million trade unionists in the public sector, from health through education to local government and the civil service and the fire service, stand together, they are much, much harder to defeat than if they try each one on their own. We've had 7 years of people being on their own, and that has meant defeat. I think if we now start acting together, we can see some victories.
How will the position of the trade unions change if Jeremy Corbyn was to become Prime Minister?
Yes, I think Jeremy Corbyn is going to be the next elected Prime Minister in this country. I think what has happened in the last 2 months has been something like I've never seen in my lifetime. And I think that Corbyn has offered hope to people. I think he's shown there is another way. He's shown that young people can be engaged in politics. And what he did in the election, even though Labour didn't win, to have the biggest increase in their vote in any election since 1945 is a staggering. So yes, I definitely think that he can win. Are we preparing for him winning? Yes, we are, because what we are now doing is we're looking at what policies we'd like to see a Labour government bring in. We have a close relationship with the Labour Party leadership to ensure that their next manifesto absolutely builds on what they've already done to give even more hope to working people. So yes, I think he can win, and yes, I think we are prepared for it. And I very much look forward to the day, because I think a Corbyn government would transform the lives of millions of people in this country, and the unions, like everybody else, would benefit, and I think that would be a good thing.
Do you think that members and activists alike will be able to resist demoralisation if Corbyn's Labour cannot come through?
Yes, we can survive. And in fact, the fact that I'm here talking to you still as the General Secretary of PCS shows we've survived, because what the last Tory government did to our union was something that hasn't happened to anyone else in Britain, which is that they tried to bankrupt the union overnight. They withdrew people's ability to pay their union dues through their payroll in an attempt to drive us out of business. And we essentially re-recruited 160,000 people in 3 months. Never been done in British trade unionism. And it goes to show that whatever they throw at us, we can take a hit, we might be smaller, but we will never go away. So absolutely we can survive a Conservative government. But my motto, which I've often said at meetings, is you've got to hope for the best, you've got to work for the best, but you must prepare for the worst.
I think I've heard you say that before, yeah.
And I think that's a very important saying, because it means you can have your hopes and dreams, and you should try to make your dreams a reality by working for them. But if you put all your eggs in the basket of that happening, and then you lose, mm-hmm. It would be catastrophic, because there would be demoralisation and you would be rudderless, really. And I think you would become quite an easy target for a Conservative government. So whilst I hope and I'm working for the best, absolutely I prepare for the worst. And in this last general election, whilst we hoped Labour would win, nobody thought that would happen. And so whilst we were doing our bit to ensure that people understood what was at stake, we were also laying plans for a majority Conservative government and how we would resist what it would want to do to our members. Luckily, we do not have a majority Conservative government. We have a weak government. And I think the job of the unions now is to absolutely keep the pressure on the government by standing up for their members.
Your support for Labour seems like an amusing prospect now, considering that you have previously said that you couldn't envisage yourself supporting the Labour Party ever again.
Very happy to explain, because my commitment to Labour is not a lifelong thing that is a commitment to that party no matter what it does. It is a commitment to a party because of what it says it's for. And so when I said I would never be a member of the Labour Party, in fact, when I described Tony Blair's government as the worst in history for public sector workers, it was because at that time, the Labour Party under Tony Blair led us into an illegal war. It turned its back on the trade unions. It introduced pay restraint. It started attacking pensions. And it started privatisation, introduced tuition fees. It was a terrible government. And I had no loyalty to that government whatsoever. In fact, I was one of those in the trade union movement arguing we should fight that government because of what it was doing. Now my change of heart has been because Labour is nothing like the Labour of Tony Blair. It is the Labour Party of a socialist who has socialist policies that I very much believe are in the interests of people of this country. And so that is why I support Labour. But hey, if this all turned around and Jeremy Corbyn was forced out of office and suddenly a Tony Blair lookalike was in charge of Labour,
you'd withdraw your support.
Then I would absolutely withdraw my support, yes.
What do you make of, for instance, the fact that practically all media outlets got the election so wrong? Can you offer an alternative vision for the future of the press?
Well, first of all, I think a radical press that is truly independent, that people can report what they see and what they think and what they find is essential in a democracy. And therefore, my advice to you or any aspiring journalist would be to follow the story, to be brave, to report what you see. And that is a critical thing in a democracy. I think the problem with the British media is that that often isn't allowed to happen, not because of the journalists, but because if you look at our printed media, it is owned by handfuls of vastly, vastly rich, usually not British citizens, who dominate the media line, which is why virtually every press, free paper, with the exception of The Guardian and The Daily Mirror and perhaps The Independent, supported the Tories in the election.
Are you referring directly to the Rupert Murdoch empire there?
Rupert Murdoch, but not just Rupert Murdoch, there's been others before him, like Conrad Black. And obviously now the debate is Rupert Murdoch wants to get involved with Fox and Sky News. And I think there is a worry about our media being owned by a handful of very rich individuals who could try to use that to, if you like, undermine free and democratic politics. But that is not to confuse the ownership of the media with the excellent job that many of our journalists do. And I think some of the most courageous trade unionists, I may add, are members of the National Union of Journalists, our war correspondents, our investigative reporters, people who are prepared to challenge politicians by asking them difficult questions. They are vital in a democracy, and long may that continue.
Do you have any final words to the listeners of Bristol?
My final thought would be, if you have listened to this interview, if you are not in a trade union, please join one. And if you are in a union, make sure you get active in it, because ultimately a union is about its members. Thanks very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm joined on the line now by Sophie Sweetman. She's a freelance journalist, writes a lot about technology. Sophie, first of all, I'd just like to ask you about the situation with, particularly with smartphones and software for them, because it seems as if the choice is narrowing. Am I right or wrong?
Yes, it seems as if the market has changed a lot in the last at least 10 years. I mean, in 2009, I'm looking at an article by the Indian Express, and looking at in 2009, Nokia and BlackBerry had 75% of the market. And the three now are Google, who obviously they're not specific software, I mean, handset designers, they're all over the shop, then Apple and Microsoft. They've got 99% of the market now.
99%, amazing. And so basically Nokia and BlackBerry are being kicked out. Now, you know, it's interesting that they've gone from the handset designers over to the software manufacturers. What sort of relationship is there between the people that make Android, which is Google, and AppleSoft, I suppose it is, and the actual people that make the handsets themselves? What's their relationship?
Well, I'm trying to work that out, because I'm trying to work out what other things that Microsoft, Apple and Google do in terms of their wider reach, rather than a more dedicated handset designer like Nokia and BlackBerry, and why Nokia and BlackBerry are the two that the free messaging services, WhatsApp, Skype, Facebook Messenger and Twitter, have all withdrawn from older phones. If that makes sense, so they've actually come away from those.
Well, you know what this reminds me of.
Sorry to interrupt you,
but this reminds me of people like Microsoft withdrawing support for older versions of Windows, and the same with other software manufacturers. They'll say, "Well, look, you just have to upgrade. There's no choice anymore." And by the way, all the new software, we're designing it to work with the new operating systems. So the idea is you're forced in a certain direction. Software you bought a few years ago maybe is now useless. So there is, it seems, a very close relationship between you've got three things here, I suppose, is the operating systems, which are the very sort of basic bit of software that's being used. That's usually Windows for most people most of the time, although it could be Android on your phone, and with the operators, the people that make the computers that make the smartphones, and then there's the apps that go on top of it. So from what you know, what's the trend been over the last 10 years?
Well, I've really looked at it from 2009, and I was just somewhere the other day talking to someone, and something happened in 2011, and that seemed like a whole different world from what we've got now. But for instance, on the Android front, I've got a BlackBerry Priv, which is actually based on an Android operating system. But the BlackBerry Smart, the first BlackBerry like smartphone, the 2013 one, that is now obsolete in terms of using apps. So people who've got older phones are now literally only able to get telephone, text and email. They can't get any.
And that's
any
only 4 years ago.
Yes. And the other thing that happened in 2013 that, and I'm still researching into the link with this, is secure hash algorithm change, because it was HD5, and that was the new one that was actually phased out in 2013.
Can you explain what that is, though? What is that?
Well, basically, a secure hash algorithm is a system that came in secure hash algorithm one was finally phased in 2013, and the previous one was phased out. And it's where you encrypt everything that goes over the internet is encrypted. So it's like, how many times is it encrypted? And they've now phased it to one that, how likely would it be for someone to be able to kind of copy it so that they could actually put out a website? So you think you're on Facebook, it says Facebook, but it's not. It's one that's been created by someone else, and they've managed to get the information to make it look like it, but it's not. So they thought the older one, HD5, that wasn't very secure, and so they brought in the new system of the secure hash algorithm, which is basically where you've encrypted everything on the internet. And then now they thought that one isn't going to be secure for long enough, so they've already phased that out. So website, if you go to a website on a SHA-1, then it will just tell you you've got warnings, it's not secure, and, you know, that it probably won't let you see the website. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, yeah, the browser. I mean, I've been getting this myself.
Algorithm. It's the same as the one that they're now phasing out, but it's just a lot more encryption. So, like,
but I mean, it seems to me almost like they're banging their head against a brick wall here, because every time they bring one of these out, then they say, "Oh gosh, this isn't going to be secure for long enough. We're going to have to bring another one out." There is this sort of amazing kind of planned obsolescence almost built into IT generally. But look, the real problem to me, I mean, this is the beginning of last year. That's, I think it was January, February 2016, where you saw at least Microsoft and Google were really competing with each other. That is to say, through the Windows operating system for phones, they were having court cases against each other, Microsoft suing Google, Google suing Microsoft. And then around about February 2016, they seemed to have some kind of like love-in down at the pool and toasted each other with their cocktails and decided to drop all the court cases against each other. And now it looks like they're more like a cartel or a kind of bunch of gangsters kind of working with each other to exploit and make money out of all of the customers. So they're saying, well, look, Google, you guys have this bit of territory, we'll have that bit of territory, and we'll sell our drugs or sell our wares to those people or those people. So is that what you've seen, Sophie? I wonder what you make of the relationship between these two big players, Google and Microsoft.
Well, I wasn't looking so much at the relationship between them, because a lot of where there's been challenges and criticism has been about the Investigatory Powers Technical Capabilities Act, of what the government has now been asking all the software designers and the smartphone creators and everyone else to allow them to do, and to get them to store everyone's data for a year. And just about everybody is saying to the government, including MPs and people in the House of Lords, that this has to be entirely rethought. And Theresa May has been working on this since 2012 when she was Home Secretary, and she got the royal assent in, I think it was last year,
that's
2016.
Right. Well, I mean, this
December.
Is people forget this about Theresa May, don't they? That she was behind the snoopers charges. She was the one that finally got it pushed through, even though nobody, it seemed, apart from the most authoritarian, you know, even say Big Brother lobby within Westminster. There was only a handful of people that actually wanted it, and she was the one that, you know, I look at her as Prime Minister now thinking maybe that was her reward for getting this awful bit of legislation through, the Big Brother Act.
Well, it's something that would just be good for people to discuss more widely, because there seems to be a whole string of events. I mean, she was the Home Secretary in 2012 when she introduced it for the first time, and then she became Prime Minister after David Cameron left. She was voting for Remain, so she was a Remainer, but then she ended up being the only horse in the race to become the leader of the Conservative Party after Michael Gove was voted out and Andrea Leadsom sort of slipped up in an interview. And
well, no, Andrea Leadsom actually deliberately said
May
no.
Ended up as our Prime Minister.
Andrea Leadsom fell on her sword, leaving there no actual election. So you got about 120,000 members of the Tory party, none of whom had any say in it. So that was a little bit sneaky.
Theresa May's become Prime Minister. She's now got the royal assent for this in December 2016. She's then put it into consultation. It came out on the 19th of May. And yet there's been so much opposition. It's been opposition from Mozilla Firefox and, you know, Google, Microsoft and Apple have all provided, when they've been given a warrant, to provide information, like in terms of messages. Because when you send a message, it's encrypted from when you send it to when the person reads it. But then they've got all these things like backup. And then also they do all this audio recordings. They've got ways that if something's backed up, it can be looked at without it being encrypted, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So
now, anyway,
it just
I know
seems
you've,
there's so much going on.
You've looked into Stephen Hawking's sister, was it? Dr. Mary Hawking. And found that some of the things that she said.
She's involved with healthcare technology.
And what did she have to say about all this?
Well, I was trying to look for, it was a forum post where she mentioned in 2010 that BlackBerry refused to sort of like reduce their amount of security and encryption on people's handsets. They didn't want that, because there was a whole thing at one point where Theresa May was just suggesting that the internet shouldn't be encrypted so that everybody, you know, they could look at everything. And one of the things she said after that first attack in Westminster of this year, the one, I think it was February. Is it February?
March.
Had been using WhatsApp, and they didn't want people to hide in dark corners of the internet, but the person acted alone, so to say what to who. You know, so it's like, you know, just literally using, oh, this person who did this atrocious act used WhatsApp to kind of justify why people's messages on WhatsApp, Skype, Facebook Messenger and Twitter.
But Mary Hawking's point, though?
Well, she was just saying that the BlackBerry that she had at the time was becoming obsolete, that she wasn't getting the functionality out of it.
Yeah, that's because it seems that these other people have been sort of pushing people out of the way. Anyway, Sophie, a lot of this stuff is extremely important for the future of humanity because it's about the way we communicate. A lot of it, of course, is to do with the way we get our news as well. And we really do want to have some kind of system whereby we're not being constantly snooped on. Could you just tell us whereabouts we can find you on the internet?
Yes. Well, I've got a website, which is Sophie Sweetman, and Sweetman is spelt Sweatman, sophiesweetman.com. And I do a show every Friday on Source FM, which is a radio station in South Cornwall. And the website is thesourcefm.co.uk. And that being Source, the beginning of everything, rather than what you put on your dinner.
And have you got any, like, single tip, one little tip for people just to help with their understanding computers? Because it does seem like when you connect up to the internet also connects up to your life, and that might not necessarily be to your advantage.
Well, I just like, when I see a story, I just like to look around, and I'll start with Google, but often results might not be entirely as good. Well, Google seems to be a lot less good than it used to be, so I might try Yahoo, might try other search engines, but sometimes you just have to get very creative and just go to one article, see something, and the story just builds up, so you could find all sorts of things and just get somewhere without going down conventional routes in terms of researching things. But I do find if you're focusing on something, you do find there are a lot of people out there who are probably focusing on the same thing. And then they'll find that way to get that information to you, whether it's over Reddit or Twitter. Twitter can be good sometimes. And all the ways that you can find information if you look for information and get creative with how you search for it.
Okay. For many people who haven't used Reddit, what is it in a nutshell?
Well, it's another social media site. You've got so many. You've got Path. They all work in slightly different ways, but they're becoming more homogenised now. So it's one where people post and they might put up, when something's actually happening, they might put up a picture and, oh my God, there's something happening at this marathon. Or they might just, but it tends to go under topic. I suppose that's the only thing, rather than other things going under when someone's posted or algorithms. It is something where you could put in a topic. You can put in a topic and find everything's everything people are saying on that topic.
Okay, and also with phones, I mean, everybody knows that there are certain types of anti-virus software and things like that you can buy for your laptop, but is there anything for the phones that can actually work on there? Because there doesn't seem to be any kind of proper security at all on our smartphones.
Well, that's true. I've got BullGuard security for my phone, and it does check things clean and clear, because I've got a Priv, which is a BlackBerry, and apparently it's based on a Google operating system. But this BullGuard security, I had quite a look around to see what there was, and it seems to work, but every so often now it says it stopped working, so I'm not really sure exactly what it's doing, really. But yeah,
maybe Google have decided that they don't like it, and it stops people getting it into their phones.
I think that all the individual companies, from Mozilla Firefox, who make an internet browser, through to the actual handset manufacturers, and even Google and Apple, they are finding ways. They are on the side of keeping people secure. So they're also saying, you know, to the government, we can't just let you snoop on 6,500 people all the time. And it doesn't seem to work to stop people doing, you know, carrying out acts. It doesn't seem to do anything. We've had quite a few this year, and none of them have been caught committing their plans to text over any kind of...
No, well, I mean, any terrorist with half a brain cell would know you don't go on the internet to plan your terrorist attack, I would have thought.
Exactly, I would have thought that.
Anyway, look, Sophie Sweetman, thanks very much, freelance journalist, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
That's great, I'm off down the beach now, so...
Okay, cheers, Sophie.
Cheers, bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Ken Gibson. I'm born here in the U.S. to a U.S. military family, at least on my mother's side. I joined the U.S. Navy in about 1980 or 79, whenever, and was into intel because they found out that I had Cyrillic reading ability, some Russian language skills, some other language skills. After the Navy, I interested myself in investigations and hung out with a lot of people who had been in some form of intel or another, ex-CIA agents, DIA agents, etc. Wrote a book about hemp and the suppression involving hemp and U.S. companies that started World War II behind the scenes using Hitler as their puppet. Also another book about the suspicions regarding 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. In both of these books, I made a lot of notes about the FBI, which I've tangled while working on the side of law. I've found that the FBI is often working against law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, before we get into some of the more current stuff, can you just outline the connections between hemp and the Nazis?
Okay, there was a company that had an interest in suppressing hemp called DuPont. At one time, this was the largest company in the world. DuPont was started in early 19th century. The DuPonts had been expelled from France, and they came to the United States on the 1st of January, 1800. Their main product was ammunition, so they liked to have wars going. They made a lot more money during war, obviously. In World War II, they were supplying both sides. They had secret agreements. People like Howard Armbruster, who wrote Treason's Peace, made a lot of notes on this, other authors as well. And they went into U.S. government files to back up their claims. And I included a lot of that information to show the character of DuPont as a company that would do things illegally to suppress hemp.
Now, as someone that's worked in intelligence, in U.S. Naval Intelligence, Kenyon, I mean, there is this organization that was set up, I believe, by a guy called David Attlee Phillips, who was a former CIA intelligence officer, many of whom actually pointed the finger at him as being one of the people involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which is supposed to be an organization for former intelligence officers. It does seem as if that kind of organization would be an interesting one. Only thing is, it's set up by one of the guys who was behind the assassination of JFK.
Yeah, a lot of intel in the U.S. runs things behind the scenes, and I have no doubt that JFK was assassinated, that there was the presence of George W. Bush in Dallas that day, and that he was assassinated for a number of reasons, all or most of which were going against the financial interests of people, including his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, who then started the Vietnam War, feeding a lie to the American people so that certain companies could get into Vietnam, which is much the same scenario as is happening in Syria now. And I'd like to, I mentioned what happened in Vietnam so that we can look back on the past and prevent another Vietnam from happening.
I mean, people do look upon the assassination of JFK as a very significant event in the Western world. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Who could disagree?
Because, I mean, at the time, there were all the hopes from the Second World War. President Eisenhower had warned. He said, you know, you've got these military-industrial complex kind of hanging around in the background, potential for misplaced power. And it almost seems as if that misplaced power took over when JFK was assassinated.
I think that's absolutely correct. My mother was watching that day, and she said that Lyndon B. Johnson jumped up on the podium with a weird smile on his face and said, "I'm in charge." Right after that, Johnson's friends made a lot of money in Vietnam, which Johnson started using the lie about an attack on a U.S. ship, which the commander of the U.S. ship flatly denied. So you're right, and having a knowledge of President and former General Eisenhower's warning about the MIC is a key bit of information. Everyone should have that. I would hope that that's taught in every high school in America. Well, I don't think it was.
A lot of people point to what's happened with Iraq and Syria as being a kind of almost an extension of that. And I know you've got some real concerns that the whole lie of WMD might be used again in Syria.
Any kind of lie, and there are a lot of suspicions about the sarin gas. When you see pictures of people treating the victims with no masks, no gloves, that's not how you treat a sarin gas attack.
Well, why not? I mean, surely these people are just there at the scene. They don't necessarily have this specialist equipment.
They have some amount, and certainly gloves. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a paramedic. I have gloves. I have hospital-quality gloves in my room. They're commonly available. You don't go anywhere as a medic without gloves. And I mean, if you treat somebody for a cold, you have gloves. Yet these people were supposedly treating sarin gas attacks without the gloves. And what is much more plausible is that ISIS actually bombed, or that an ISIS warehouse with some amount of chlorine containing compounds was bombed in the attacks, and that naturally, very unfortunately, but naturally happened. To say that the Russians and the Syrians are cold-blooded murderers dropping sarin gas on people without proof is just wrong.
Well, we've had James Mattis, the new U.S. Defense Secretary, and then also Michael Fallon, the British Defense Secretary, saying that if there is another chemical weapons attack by the Assad regime, as they call it, we will call it, as it should be called, the government, by the Syrian Arab Army in Syria, then their reaction will be swift. But that does imply a bit of a problem, is that they won't necessarily look into who's caused it before acting.
And you have to look at who is acting in Syria. On the 2nd of November, you had me on the radio, and thank you for that. I brought up the name Michael Bagley. Bagley is head of a company called Jellyfish, and he used to work for Operations Intelligence. He was recruited by Jellyfish. He was sent to Syria, and I met him at Penn Station. I spoke to him undercover, acting as if I was a member of an international group of Nazis and terrorist supporters. He knew somebody in London named Jonathan Boulter, who is a serious sadist and into all these groups. Boulter sent me an email saying that Syria was to become a mini Halliburton and Bagley had the keys to Syria. Bagley represents one of the three branches of U.S. intelligence, and that's private intelligence, the other two being military intelligence and government intelligence, which is CIA, DIA, NSA, Homeland Security, etc. So private intel companies being used to do what they want, with the American government able to deny what's going on, but also these private intel agencies, as Bagley told me, he basically laughed at the notion that he was doing this for Americans. He's never been a serviceman. He told me flat out he was doing it for the money. And Trump comes to power
in January of this year, and he doesn't know what's going on. The private intel companies just hope to create their mini Halliburton, make a lot of money like they've done elsewhere around the world and in Vietnam, as I just mentioned. So Trump sees a mess, and one day something bad happens, as is happening every day. And his daughter comes to him and says, "Daddy, you know, kids are being killed." And Trump puts a stop to it in a very humanitarian way. I have to give him credit. He called and said, "Look, we're going to bomb you, so why don't you get out of the way, but we want to get rid of these chemical weapons." So no civilians were killed. There was no loss of American soldiers either. He did as the commander-in-chief ought to have done. He got some criticism. He got support. But he's acting, he was not acting out of a desire to hurt Russia, hurt Syria, or hurt anyone. And that's very important. Unfortunately, though, with secret actors like Michael Bagley and Jellyfish, a.k.a. Blackwater, as it used to be called, but it changes its name, maybe because it's ashamed of its past activities, in there, nobody really knows what's going on. So Russia and America are brought to friction over the actions of people like Michael Bagley, just as America and Vietnam were brought to war because people like whoever the forces were that killed John F. Kennedy wanted the war for their own profit.
Now, so I know you've actually successfully infiltrated fascist groups in the UK. Can you just tell us, I mean, because most people, and you would maybe equate those with satanic groups, can you just give us an idea of what these groups were like when you infiltrated them and how they operate?
Well, there was a range of groups, from small groups that had very few members, and the fewer members, the more outraged they were. So, trying to remember his name now, but there's a guy, Kevin Quinn. Kevin Quinn was probably the most outrageous because he openly claimed that he believed in Nazism and Red Mein Kampf. He had the least members, and he changed the name of his group from the November 9th Society to the British First Party. Then there was the British People's Party, which was very small. The British National Party, which was the biggest, but shied away from out-and-out Nazism. They had a lot of problems after they were infiltrated by a Guardian reporter in about 2008. And I got into a lesser-known group that has the most power of them all called New Right. New Right had meetings of about 60 people once a month in London at a secret location. You'd come to its location, and then everybody would get a secret text telling you that wasn't the location, and Jonathan Boulter would show up and lead you to a pub. There'd be four speakers. I was a speaker on a couple of occasions, but mainly the speakers were all anti-Semitic. And you had a range of people who were also anti-Muslim to Muslim-speaking who hated Jews. But anti-Semitism was a common denominator there. And there was a lot of networking going on. So some people in that group were just right-wing activists who had no clue, and they paid their $5 to sit in this group and have a pint downstairs. And then others were much more powerful, like Jonathan Boulter, who personally knew Adrian Davies QC, who knew the late Jonathan Bowden, who knew Darius Guppy, the man who punched out Princess Diana's brother. And so the more powerful elite in these groups went around the world and had contacts with people like Michael Bagley. They are rather silly groups. So let me explain. You're a taxpayer, and these funds that you give to the government every year get partially allocated to intelligence agencies, and in the U.S., private intelligence agencies, and these private intelligence agencies then turn around and use this money to create problems and wars and make money for themselves and their affiliates.
Okay. Also, you've come across this group called MS-13 you're quite worried about. Who are they, and why are you worried?
Well, they rape people, they chop people up as a matter of course. They have a violent indoctrination program for their members, which is why they're called MS-13.
So who are they? But who are these people? Where are they from?
Okay, they started after the war in San Salvador. They were fighting against the Sandinistas. They came to Los Angeles in the 80s, and they wanted to become the number one gang in all of the United States. So they're enemies with Barrio 18, and they want to become so violent that everybody fears them. So they beat up children in satanic sacrifices. They randomly attack people. They recruit kids on the internet. they are just complete animals. Anybody should just wiki it. We could talk for hours about all the instances, but in about a 5-minute wiki search, anybody would agree that I'm talking about one of the most demonic gangs on the face of the earth. In fact, they tattoo themselves with devil horns and 666.
Okay, so what we'll do is we'll put up a link on our show page at dialectradio.co.uk to, and I'll find some information on MS-13. Watch out for them, folks. Anyway, Kenyon Gibson, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, bye-bye.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car or anywhere you like. And subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you want to at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests. That is Mark Sawatka, interviewed by Dialect's Imogen Sawatka, his daughter. Also Sophie Sweetman, who is on thesourcefm.co.uk, Cornwall radio station. And Kenyon Gibson, naval intelligence veteran, talking about Syria and fascism just then. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production casts us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, if you like, just off Jamaica Street in Bristol, 0117 909 6897. Or they're online at prsc.org.uk. Or you can go to the National Volunteering website and volunteer for us or anyone else in Bristol or anywhere else in the country for that matter. That's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. Thank you.
Libra, Leo, Cancer,
Ralph,
Charles, Paul, Larry.
Now I like a woman who loves her freedom, and I like a woman who can hold her own. And if you fit that description, baby, come with me. Take my hand.
And my name is Larry, and I like a woman that loves everything and everybody, because I love everybody and everything. And you know what, ladies, if you feel that this is you, then this is what I want you to do.